Hey, everybody, Dave Hodges here. I am the host of the Common Sense Show. We are the show that is freeing America one enslaved mind at a time. And we're covering one of my two or three favorite topics, and that will be the Kennedy assassination. In particular, we have an expert on Jim DiEugenio as his third appearance on the show. We had two of his colleagues, if you remember, on last fall at the anniversary time, and terrific. And he's written a book here, and you can see in the background here JFK assassination, the chokehold. I love the references to this book. When we covered this book before, a fantastic response from the audience. You're going to love this. And what we're going to find out is what the CIA is releasing and what Jim thinks they're up to, or what we have learned. Are there any new insights he's experienced? And I have a selfish reason for doing this. I don't care if you like the president or not. We do not need to have coup d'etats where presidents are taken out. I don't care if it's Joe Biden. I don't care if it's Obama. I don't care if it's Donald Trump. More we learn about this topic, the more this serves as a buffer where guys think maybe we can't get away with it because too much is known about the alternatives. At least that's wishful thinking on my part. Hey, we're coming to you from the Noble Gold Studios. And I'll tell you, Noble Gold has really been my savior. I don't trust the banks. I know much more of them are in trouble than what the FDIC is admitting to and what the Federal Reserve is admitting to. And what I'm going to tell you right now is that you need to go precious metals until we clear this storm. Because as the dollar dies, gold and silver will rise. You need to jump on this. In fact, gold's gone up 46% in the last year. Some people think it's going to hit 4,500 this year. Don't let this opportunity pass you by. Go to Noble Gold. In fact, I can send you out a free information packet, easy to remember, davehodgesgold.com. Just put your email in, and then you'll have the number there for Noble Gold once you get an explanation in more detail of what I'm talking about. That's davehodgesgold.com.
This meeting is being recorded.
Anyway, we want to get to the program here because time is short and we've got a lot to cover. You can see we don't have the book image in the background, but we will clearly tell you how to get a copy of this book more than once before we leave. And when we post this on hard media like social media, and we post it on our website, our newsletter, we'll have all the stuff there that you need to be able to order this book. Jim, welcome to the show. It's great to have you back. And I have been so looking forward to this. Just a broad question to begin with. Has the release of these files changed your mind or led you in a different direction regarding your previous conclusions on the JFK assassination?
No, they haven't changed my mind. They have essentially kind of reinforced what I was thinking.
Yeah, the one thing that I saw in your congressional testimony, and you get a 5-star rating for this, the way it was presented, I could see the reaction of some of the people around you and also some of the congressmen. They were shocked. The Stroud memo. I'd like to start with that. The Stroud memo told me what I already believed to be true. Oswald didn't shoot. What did you take from that?
All right, let me explain what that is. See, Victoria Adams and Sandy Stiles were on the stairs at what had to be the same time that Oswald was coming down from the sixth floor. Now, the Stroud memo was a document that the Assistant Attorney General in the Dallas-Fort Worth area sent to the Warren Commission. In that document, it states that Dorothy Garner, the supervisor of Adams and Stiles, came out of their offices at the same time that the two girls did, except she stayed on the fourth floor. That's very important because she then said, "I watched as Sandy and Victoria went down the stairs, and then the policeman and Roy Truly, the supervisor, came up." No Oswald. Okay. All right. Now, she sent that in the summer of 1964. The Warren Commission was not published until late September of 1964.
Mm-hmm.
You won't see the Stroud document in the 26 volumes of testimony and evidence. And in fact, Barry Ernest, a guy who wrote a book about Victoria Adams, found it in 1999 as a result of the Assassination Record Review Board's declassification process. So it only took us, what, 35 years? To, you know? All right. See, and this is the problem that we have with the John F. Kennedy case, is that here we are now, 62 years later, and we're still waiting to get the last documents. This is what I said in my testimony. I said, any investigator or lawyer will tell you that before you can really investigate a case, you have to have the complete case file. Well, we never did in the John F. Kennedy case.
Well, it's interesting how they kept time releasing things, and it looks like they're still doing it now. But the question I have, and a point that I've raised on my own media, is how can we trust the data from the CIA when they've had possession of it for over six decades? And I don't believe they're going to release anything that would be embarrassing or compromising to themselves. How would you answer that?
Well, I guess the best way to answer that is to try and compare what they release with what we already know, plus with what the other agencies release.
Okay.
Now, there's such a thing as testimony against interest, which means that the person compromises himself or herself with the testimony they're going to give. Now, you said something about timed releases. Let me illustrate that point. When the review board closed down in 1998, they stamped documents with timed releases, which meant certain time in the future, they felt safe about this document being declassified. One of the documents was the notes of a woman named Betsy Wolf. Who was Betsy Wolf? Well, who is Betsy Wolf was a better question. She was an investigator for the House Select Committee on Assassinations. Her work was declassified in 2006, and it was sent to me by a very good archival researcher named Malcolm Blunt. What was her job? Her job was to examine the CIA file on Oswald. What did she do? She first asked for every charter of every division in the CIA. She read these over, made notes, and then drew a graph. Okay, this is what Oswald's CI file should do. She then asked for the file. And guess what? It didn't do that. All right? None of the documents went to where they should have, which is the Soviet-Russia division. They went to a place called OS, Office of Security. What is interesting about that is this, is that the Office of Security does not open 201 files, which is the most common file in the CIA. This is really quite weird, okay, to begin with, because no one doubted that a 201 file should have been opened on Oswald. The guy defected, and he threatened to give radar secrets to Moscow.
Mm-hmm.
So you had to have a 201 file. There wasn't one any open. So Betsy started calling in these retired CIA officers, and she said, isn't this kind of odd? You know, why did his file do this? And Dave, guess what? They all agree with her. They said, you're right. It should have gone to the Soviet-Russia division, and there should have been a 201 file open immediately. So finally, In 1978, in November of 1978, she calls in the present chief of security at the CIA, a guy named Bob Gambino. She asks him this question. And Gambino said, look, it doesn't matter how many documents come in or if they're pre-stamped. If the client has gone to the first gate, which is the Office of Mail Logistics, the documents will go to that office and that office only. Now, I really want to hammer home why this is important.
Okay.
Because Oswald's file was being rigged from the time he went to the Soviet Union. Yeah. Who even knew about this guy at that time? This 19-year-old misfit is so important that the CIA is rigging his files from the moment he leaves the United States. Why? I mean, we didn't know about this till 2006. All right? Now here's my question. Here's another question. You will not find this information in the House Select Committee volumes either. They didn't want to touch it. All right? It's sort of like, if you watch my testimony, the 42 witnesses who saw the hole in the back of John F. Kennedy's head, the House Select Committee didn't want anything to do that either.
Well, yeah, they didn't call the Parkland doctors. That's egregious.
Dave. What they didn't do is they covered up what the Bethesda doctors saw. They tried to say that the only people who saw this blasted out back of the skull were the people at Parkland. And since they were emergency physicians who didn't have the body for long, they wanted to favor the Bethesda doctors, all right? So they, and there's no other way to say this, they lied. If you look to volume 7, page 37, they misrepresented the witnesses at Bethesda, because when the review board opened up all the files from the House Select Committee, guess what? They saw the same thing that the doctors at Parkland saw. Okay. 42 witnesses in two different places saw this blasted out back of the skull, which I don't have to tell you, strongly indicates a shot from the front, which could not have been taken by Oswald.
Is it true also, and this is kind of ancillary, but Oswald was not a marksman. He had trouble passing his marksmanship test twice in boot camp. Is there truth to that?
If you take a look at Henry Hurt's book, Reasonable Doubt, he interviewed a lot of the people who were on the target range with Oswald. By the time Oswald left the Marine Corps, let's put it this way. He was not a very good shot.
Okay.
And that people saw him said that he would miss the whole target, right? So, yes, that's a problem.
let me run through a few more things about Oswald, because you've raised a great point. So that brings in some of what I've seen in other documentaries and books. Besides not being a very good shot, he was taught to speak Russian. And he would have knowledge of U-2 spy planes, and he might have been part of the defector program where he was going to trade that info in hope of getting bigger info back. Is there any truth to all that?
Well, let's take up your first point. Before Oswald left the United States, he had dinner with a woman named Rosalind Quinn. Rosalind Quinn was taking Russian classes with a tutor because she wanted to work for the State Department. She had taken these classes for over a year. She went out to dinner with Oswald, and she was very surprised because she said, he spoke better Russian than I did. And I was really surprised that I would throw questions at him, and he would come back with these answers in Russian. All right. So here's the question. what was Oswald doing learning Russian when he was a radar operator?
Yeah,
all right.
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Now, your second question, there was a false defector program going on at this time. There were at least 12 or 13 men from the military or the intelligence agencies or related companies that ended up defecting to the Soviet Union in about a 3 or 4 year period. And many people believe that this is what Oswald was supposed to do. Now, as your third point, what would make him of value to Moscow was the fact that he was a radar operator who was stationed at the same base that the U-2 flew out of,
right,
which was at Sugi in Japan. So these are all very, very interesting areas of Oswald's background, which the Warren Commission made little or nothing out of.
Well, it seems like whatever connection he had to Intel, they tried to take him away. When he was arrested, let's dispel another story that relates to this. Did he have a Naval Intelligence ID card with the name Alex Heidel on it with his picture?
That's a question that I really can't answer in an affirmative way. But this question about the ID, this surfaced many years later when Bob Barrett, an FBI agent, said that there was an ID left at the scene of the Tippit murder. And it was Oswald's, okay? You know? And that had always been covered up for many, many, many years, all right? And in fact, I don't think it ever came out until the 1990s, you know? So this is so interesting because the official story says that the police took an ID out of Oswald's wallet as they were driving him to the station. And it doesn't end there. There was another one found at the home of Ruth and Michael Payne. So, Dave, here's my question to you. Do you know anybody who carries three wallets?
They were creating an image to maybe lead away from the CIA. Would you agree with that?
Well, I would have to agree with that. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
There was another thing I wanted to ask you about, too, because it looks to me like not only did they create that ONI identity to have plausible deniability for the CIA, but when you had the Fair Play for Cuba in front of the very building that Oliver Stone in his movie identified, they're running guns for the Cuban refugees through that building at 545 Camp Street. And Oswald's passing out leaflets with that address on it, by mistake. And he's the only member of the Fair Play for Cuba masquerading as a Marxist communist. Was that the creation of a phony identity to use him later?
Yeah, it was a Heidel, this A.J. Heidel identity.
Yes.
All right. But getting back to your original point, here's what's so strange about this, and we found this out in the newly declassified documents. Both the FBI and the CIA had infiltration programs going on against the Fair Play for Cuba Committee, which was headquartered in New York. And in fact, some of the people involved in this were Carta Deloach, who was a number three guy at the FBI, David Phillips, a very important figure in the JFK case for the CIA, and Jim McCord, who later became famous with Watergate. So these guys are all surveilling, monitoring, and infiltrating the Fair Play for Cuba Committee at the time Oswald is doing his charade there in New Orleans. And as you said, on at least one of his flyers, and likely more, he actually printed 544 Camp Street as the FTC headquarters. That happens to be the building that both Guy Bannister had his office and the Cuban Revolutionary Council had their offices. And they were both CIA affiliated. All right. So here's the question. What is a communist doing with that address on the flyers he's handing out? And let me give you the capper. Let me give you the capper on this. Because this is another thing we found out. Jesse Corr was Clay Shaw's right-hand man at the International Trademark. When Oswald was doing his leafleting on Canal Street, Jesse Corr just happened to be there. He picked up one of those flyers with Bannister's office printed on the back. Guess what he did? He took it back to the trademark. He circled the address, drew an arrow to it, and sent it to the FBI office in New Orleans. Now, if that is not very odd, first of all, how did Jesse Corr know the significance of that address? And secondly, why would he send it to the FBI? You know, did he know something about Oswald at that time that nobody else knew? And would he not share it with his boss, Clay Shaw?
And Clay Shaw, of course, was tried by Jim Garrison for plotting the murder of John Kennedy.
Yeah, conspiring in the murder of John F. Kennedy. Yes. Right.
Oh, that is amazing. My guess, you know, if we don't have any other info, if I had to guess, I would say he circled the address because Oswald screwed up monumentally and identified an operational entity for the Bay of Pigs operation.
Yes, I would agree with that.
Boy, that's I did not know that Clay Shaw's subordinate was involved with Oswald there. That's a game changer for me. I've got to rethink that. Mm-hmm. That is absolutely amazing. There's another thing I want to clean up, too, before we go back to your testimony in Congress. It's been alleged in the series, I believe it was The Men Who Killed Kennedy, that Oswald was given a nitrate test or a form of a nitrate test the night of the arrest and the day of the assassination of Kennedy and the murder of Officer Tippit. So where he allegedly fired 8 shots and yet he tested negative. Is there any truth in that?
He tested negative on his cheek. All right. Highly indicative that he didn't fire a rifle that day, because I'm sure you know the rifle he was handling, the Mannlicher Carcano, was a bolt action rifle,
right,
in which you had to pull back the bolt on the receiver and bring it backwards and then shove it forward again and put it up to your cheek to line up the scope. So how you could fire that rifle without getting the nitrates on your cheek is very mysterious.
You'd have to fire without aiming.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, that's absolutely amazing. So now the Stroud memo and this information strongly suggest he didn't fire a shot that day. And he was what he said when the media was asking him questions when he was being processed. I'm just a patsy. He might have been telling the truth there.
Well, I think he was telling the truth. All right. And Oswald began to suspect what was happening to him, right? When he said something, they arrested me because I've been to the Soviet Union and I work in that building. All right. And then he didn't even know that they were charging him with the murder of Kennedy. He thought they were just charging him with the murder of the police officer, J.D. Tippit. If you watch the films, when Oswald is alerted to that, the look of shock and surprise that come over his face are very notable. Now, I don't know if you know this or if your listeners know about it. Saturday night, Oswald made a request to make a phone call to a guy named John Hurt in North Carolina. He submitted the request. The Secret Service rejected it. All right. One of the secretaries put it into a trash can. The other secretary, before she left her shift, fished it out of the trash can. She was curious. Who the heck was Oswald trying to call? All right. And so she showed it to an attorney. And guess what? John Hurt was a military intelligence officer based in North Carolina, which is where the state where the NAGS head base is, which naval intelligence defectors were groomed to go to the Soviet Union. When Victor Marchetti, a former CIA agent, saw this, he said Oswald slit his throat with making that request. Because as we know, the next day, Jack Ruby goes in and snuffs out Oswald.
Here's what bothers me. Ruby's known to the Dallas police. He is into all kinds of nefarious underworld criminal activities. How the heck does he get in the basement of the garage and close enough to kill Oswald if it wasn't planned to do so?
Well, that's a very good question. Jack Ruby was known to approximately two-thirds of the police force because he would ply them with drinks, with food, with girls from his clubs.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And in fact, that's why he was allowed to roam through that police headquarters that weekend, because everybody knew him. He was a friend of the police force. Now, how did he get in? That's a very key question.
Yes.
See, the guy who was guarding the Main Street ramp always insisted that Ruby did not come down that way. All right. What really happened, and the House Select Committee discovered this, they interviewed a guy named Sergeant Dunn Flush. Flush was right opposite that ramp. He had parked his car there because he wanted to see the transfer. He told the House Select Committee, there's no way Jack Ruby came down the Main Street ramp. I knew Jack Ruby, and I would have remembered him going down that ramp. All right. Now, he passed, and the guard passed polygraph test. All right. But the guy in charge of security, Patrick Dean, did not, even though he wrote his own questions. Okay. If you can't pass a polygraph that you write your own questions to, something's wrong someplace.
Wow.
All right. All right. And so the House Select Committee came to the conclusion that it was much more likely that Ruby came in the back way. All right. Because if you go to the Dallas Police Headquarters and you look out the back windows, there's Western Union, which is the place that Ruby said he went to that morning to wire one of his girls some money. So very clearly, a guy from either Dean or somebody else could have opened that back door and let Jack Ruby in to polish off Oswald. Now, what makes that even more suspicious is that if you see the films of that parking lot, Ruby is very clearly hiding behind Blackie Harrison, this big 6'2", 240-pound policeman, okay? He's trying to conceal himself. And then the first horn goes off. Oswald comes out into the foyer. The second horn goes off. Ruby jumps out and kills him.
Amazing. Well, clearly Oswald couldn't be allowed to testify, and you just gave me a piece of information I didn't have. I didn't know the call went to Hurt, and
yes.
Naval intelligence defectors and that program to the Soviet Union. That signaled them he was going to sing like a canary if he was on trial, so they had to kill him. But here's the question I have, and to me, this speaks to really who's behind the assassination. By what coercion could Jack Ruby have embarked on what really one would consider to be a suicide mission?
Well, I don't have to go into all this because I'm sure you're aware of this. You know, Jack Ruby was associated with organized crime through people like Louis McWilly and Trafficante. In fact, there's even one witness who says that Ruby was in Cuba, all right, talking to Trafficante when Trafficante was in detention by Castro, all right? So I believe that this is what happened. I believe that when Oswald survived the Texas theater and went into detention, the CIA decided to call on their old buddies from the attempts to kill Castro, the CIA mafia plots of which Trafficante was part of. And they asked him to go ahead and bail them out of this bad situation that they were in. Trafficante makes the call to McWilly, and McWilly then makes the call to Ruby. And in fact, Ruby's friends always said, Jack admired McWilly so much that he was his idol. All right, he would do anything for him. Now, if the piece of candy didn't work, then I'm sure McWilly was going to head and give him the baseball bat in the other hand. You know, you better do this or else, okay?
Wasn't given a
And see,
choice. That was my
and you
thought.
understand, Dave. See, with the way all this sympathy going out and all the antipathy towards Oswald, Ruby might have thought that he was going to get off with a slap on the wrist, all right? You know, and in fact, most experts in the law say that that likely would have happened if he would have been granted the new trial, which I'm sure you're aware of. He was. In late 1966, the Texas Appeals Court granted him a new trial because they said it was impossible for him to get a fair trial in Dallas. And we know what happened. Ruby died a few weeks later, and he always insisted that he was infested with cancer cells, you know.
Yeah, well, I remember seeing a clip. Ruby, I think it was in the courtroom, but media asking him as he's leaving the courtroom who was involved. I can't remember who asked him the question, but he basically indicated very powerful people were involved in the assassination. And he,
That's exactly true. That was, you're exactly right. That was in a courtroom with a couple of his attorneys, and they were awaiting a decision on his appeal. And Ruby said words of the effect, very high people in our government have placed me in the position that I am in right now. All right. And then they asked them again, and they said, these are people in high places? And he said, yes. Now, Dave, there's a whole nother story I could tell about how Jack Ruby was visited by a doctor named, and I'm sure you're aware who
Are
this
you about
guy
Jolly West? Yes.
was.
Just a guess.
Yes. Jolly West visited Ruby in, I think, March of 1964. Now, if you don't know who Jolly West was one of the CIA doctors who was involved in experiments in the MK Ultra program. The MK Ultra program was the CIA's attempt to program an assassin to either kill somebody or set him up to be a fall guy. Why Jolly West would be going in to see Jack Ruby in March of 1964, and why the Dallas police would allow him into his cell is something that is really inexplicable. I have no idea why and how that happened. Well, I have an idea as to why, but I don't know why they let him do it.
Makes sense. Yeah, I've heard this story before. So that brings me to, and I'm going to ask this question, and I want to go back to your testimony. But the name Dorothy Kilgallen comes up. She announces allegedly to people like her producer, I'm going to go to Dallas and blow the lid off the Kennedy assassination. I'm talking to Jack Ruby. And then she dies under very suspicious circumstances, just like Marilyn Monroe.
Well, Dorothy Kilgallen was the only mainstream journalist working for a newspaper who even was really interested in the John F. Kennedy case. And she did several columns, all right, between 63 and 65 when she passed away, all right? And she supposedly kept a file, all right, on the JFK case. And she allegedly went to New Orleans shortly before she died. And this was a very kind of secret trip, all right? And she didn't really want very many people to know that she was going down there. And then, as you said, she died under kind of weird circumstances. Her hairdresser found her in the wrong room,
Yes.
okay, dressed, okay, reading a book that she had already finished like a week before, all right? So now, I don't know if you're aware of this, but I think they're making a movie out of this, all right? Okay, I think they're doing, Barry Levinson is going to direct it, and Jessica Chastain, I think, is going to play Kilgallen. That's at least what I get on the rumor mill.
I didn't know that. I'm surprised Oliver Stone's not doing it. But the thing too, also about Dorothy Kilgallen, her reading glasses were in the other room, and they found her. And I mean, the thing just stinks to high heaven, and it looks like one of the many murders used to cover up. She was getting too close with Jack Ruby, I think. Okay, I want to go back to your testimony now. When we talk about Ruby and mafia CIA connections well established, going back to OSS and World War II, and then obviously trying to assassinate Castro and Operation Mongoose, those associations are there. Was there anything that has come out of the CIA files that points to the origination point of who wanted Kennedy dead and had the authority to order it, and it moved down the chain of command?
Well, if you watch the testimony, both Jeff Morley and Oliver were pointing towards the counterintelligence chief, the legendary James Angleton.
Yes.
All right. In fact, Jeff pointed out that Angleton had something like 190 pages file accumulated on Oswald, and the CIA had always lied about this. You know, they have always tried to say that they had very little on Oswald. And as Jeff said, by any stretch of the words, 190 pages is not very little. Okay? All right. So Helms lied about this to Congress, right? And Joe Anitas, who was running the Cuban exiles who were involved with Oswald in the summer of 1963, he also deceived about this point. He said to the House Select Committee that he had nothing to do with any of this stuff about the Kennedy case at that time. Well, that was false, all right? Because Joe Anitas, as Jeff said, was essentially running those Cuban exiles. And many people suspect, including myself, that the Cuban exiles were involved in the plot to kill Kennedy. They despised JFK because he blew two opportunities to get Cuba back from Castro. Mm-hmm. First at the Bay of Pigs, and secondly at the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Right, and they wanted their gambling operations back.
And the mafia, you're exactly right, yeah, they wanted back in to Cuba. All right, so this provided a very good motive, you know, for these three entities. And by the way, I don't know if you're aware of this, but right off the bat, Bobby Kennedy suspected those three groups, the CIA, the Cuban exiles, and organized crime, okay, as being in on the murder of his brother, right? So it's not just me and you, Dave.
Oh,
it
I
was
know.
The attorney general.
Well, I think he even used the term, if I remember correctly, Operation Mongoose, which was a direct attempted pattern of hit jobs on Castro.
No. Mongoose itself was not part of the CIA mafia plots. Mongoose was an attempt to weaken the Castro administration and perhaps cause it to collapse internally. Neither JFK or RFK knew about the CIA mafia plots to kill Castro that were going on. That was, and let me explain how we know about this. The review board declassified the internal report by the CIA on these plots, which was commissioned by Richard Helms at the request of Lyndon Johnson. They admit in that report on page 132 and 133, we did not have any approval from any presidential administration to perform these operations. They admit that. When Johnson read the report, he told his chief of staff, Marvin Watson, the CIA was in on the murder of John F. Kennedy.
Yeah. You know, this is something that I've been told, and I do agree that the Cubans probably had some role in this, at least the Cuban refugees. But I've also been told, too, Gianconti, Trafficante, partnership with the CIA, no one wanted to touch the assassination domestically. It was too hot to handle. So they went to the Corsican Mafia in Marseille, France, where the leader turned them down, but they got a hitman who liked to be in disguises. And some people think that man was Lucien Sarti, photographed on the grassy knoll behind the picket fence. Have you ever looked at that angle as another hit team that could have been in Dallas?
Yes, and it's not true. The three guys that the late Steve L. fingered all had alibis for where they were at the time. Okay. One was in prison. One was out of the United States. The only guy that you can make any kind of case for is a guy named Soutre. All right. That's a guy who was Gene Soutre. He was reportedly in the Dallas-Fort Worth area on the day of the assassination. But he was not part of the Corsican mob. He was part of the rebel group called the OAS, which was trying to overthrow de Gaulle at that time. A group of generals had gotten together, and they decided de Gaulle had to go because he had given away Algeria its freedom. And that's who Soutre was a part of.
That, you notice my reaction. That made a lot of sense. If he would have been involved, I'm just speaking hypothetically, it would have given plausible deniability to the Corsican Mafia if they would have recruited him to do this. I'm not saying that happened, but that makes a lot of sense. Because here's what I do know. On the Men Who Killed Kennedy series, Christian David, who was one time the leader of that group, his lawyer was interviewed, and he said that Christian David would not touch the assassination when he was offered it because it was too hot to handle if it was inside the United States. And that was from his lawyer. So that really opens up. I'm going to have to put a question mark on that because I want to move on to other things. But you just really got my attention with that last comment. The other revelations that would lead. Well, let me just ask you this directly. Who do you believe in all likelihood? And I know you may have to speculate. Who really wanted Kennedy dead and then used their influences down the line to get it done? Have you ever considered that?
Who wanted JFK dead?
Who
and
had the
use their.
power? Who had the power to make people fall into line and carry it out?
Well, other people have theorized about this. And what they've concluded is that this whole myth about Oswald in Mexico City is what made everybody sit up and take notice and go into what they call CYA mode. All right. Johnson and Hoover, as you know, did this within 48 hours of the murder. You know, they saw these reports about Oswald in Mexico City, and Johnson panicked. He said, we're going to go to World War III? Okay. And so he calls in Russell, Richard Russell, and Earl Warren, and he essentially tells them, look, we're in danger of 40 million people killed. All right. I don't want to have to accuse Mr. Khrushchev of killing President Kennedy. And boy, did those guys get the message. All right. And Hoover, of course, the FBI investigation of the Kennedy case was an utter disgrace, you know? And so he fell into line also.
It's amazing. I just wonder, did they believe it or did they just have to kill the investor? See, I don't think Khrushchev had a part in it. Wasn't he negotiating with a go-between with Kennedy to stop upper atmospheric testing of nuclear weapons?
That's exactly right. And you know, Dave, that's a very good question. You know, did Johnson really believe this at the time that he went into panic mode? I mean, we know he didn't believe it later, but I have real questions about whether he believed it at the time. You know, and the reason I have these questions is because Hoover told him the voice on the tape is not Oswald's voice. And this picture that the CIA sent up, this isn't Oswald. All right? So this story that the CIA sent up was dubious right from the beginning. So did Johnson really believe it or not? I don't know. I can't tell you.
Well, I'm going to say this. My common sense kicks in. Kennedy's in the lead car, violation of Secret Service protocol. Johnson's in the rear car. And the story is that Johnson and Governor Connally had an argument about Johnson not being in the limousine with Kennedy. So I think the odds are he did know. I think Hoover came to know if he didn't know ahead of time. And there was a massive cover up. I mean, I heard a tape. A presidential tape of LBJ where he's telling Hoover in a phone conversation, and this tape was released. I think it was played out again on the men who killed Kennedy. And Hoover said, you know, there's a Senate investigation starting. And Johnson said, the last thing we need is another investigation. We need to appoint a commission that'll handle the whole thing. To me, it spoke to cover up. And
Well,
I
he did want to cover up any kind of Senate investigation. He wanted the FBI to do the only investigation. But he was influenced by calls coming in that said, look, nobody's going to believe the FBI. Okay, you should set up this blue ribbon kind of panel, all right, to go ahead and investigate the case. Well, he did, but he made sure that he intimidated the heck out of Earl Warren, and reportedly, Warren was crying when he left the White House. You know?
He didn't want any part of it.
No.
No, he was coerced into doing it. That presidential tape exists as well. And I've heard that. I didn't know the part about crying, but I heard about the part where Johnson was twisting his arm and wouldn't take no for an answer.
Yes.
That you're going to head this commission no matter what. And I think by that time, Earl Warren was privy to the fact there's more to this than I want to be involved in. That's how I took it. Wow, this is so fascinating. Let me ask you this because we're near the end and I want to talk about your book. How many more items, roughly speaking, are there that have come out of the files that we didn't get to?
Well, I think you know Tulsi Gabbard essentially rode herd over everybody because the CIA and the FBI didn't want to go along with this. And she decided to let go of approximately 75,000 pages of documents, which she said were related to the JFK case. But, and I have to say, that's more than anybody thought there was. All right. So it's going to take a long time to get through all of these documents. But I have to say, I have to give her credit because usually when you get these things, they're in redacted form. But almost every document I've seen has been pretty much unredacted. I've only seen two or three pages, of all the hundreds of pages I've reviewed that have any redactions at all. And this woman, who I'm sure you're aware of, Anna Luna, who's the chairman of this new House committee,
Correct. Yeah.
she has said, I will not accept any redacted documents, not at this day and age.
Yeah. I'm a fan of her. I think we need more people like her in Congress. I'm
You
glad
should
you
get her
brought
on
her
your
up.
show, Dave.
Yeah. Well, I'll see if I can't do that because
Yeah.
I really admire her. Let's talk about your book. It's the Chokehold's book. It's fantastic. And everybody who wants to know real history of America. And really, you get into deep state stuff, maybe without calling it, but deep state carried out this hit. Tell people how they can get it.
Okay, the title is The JFK Assassination Chokeholds.
Yes.
I'm one of five authors,
Right.
and you can go ahead and get it at Amazon, of course, Barnes and Noble, at almost Abbey Books, etc. And I from my appearance in Congress, all right, there's the interest went back up in the book, thank God. All right. And I should also say the interest went back up in the documentary that I wrote called JFK Revisited because Oliver mentioned that, in front of Congress. All right. Now, the third thing I'd like to give a blurb to is my website, kennedysandking.com.
Can you say that again?
My website called kennedysandking.com. And we
Okay.
might as well go for the Grand Slam. I also have a
All right.
Substack, James Anthony DiEugenio, in which I just wrote about our trip, me and Oliver, to Washington and what went on behind the scenes.
Fantastic. This isn't, I'm not blowing smoke at you. You are the authority, and so is Oliver. You guys are great Americans for doing this. And just one last question, brief answer, because we're out of time. Have you gotten a lot of blowback from this, from the spook, so to speak?
I was only threatened once,
Okay.
and I took it seriously, and I reported it to the FBI.
Yeah, the fox watching the hen house. Hopefully that'll change under Cash Patel. Jim, I really appreciate you and the work you do. And I have undying respect for Oliver Stone as well. So you're in good company there. And as things come out, I want to have you back on to give us the latest and how it's influenced your thinking on this, because I don't think we should ever let this die. Even if we convict these people posthumously, I think we need to do so. Jim, thanks so much for coming on. You've been a great guest. I look forward to talking to you again.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. We'll see you back here next time. I'm Dave Hodges. This is the Common Sense Show. And until next time.